Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2014. Lecture 19, delivered on April 1, 2014. The title of this lecture is Bonds, Preferred Stock, and Leases.
Today, bonds, preferred stock, and leases. Bonds, preferred stock, and leases. Now, this is almost all just information. There's no calculations. There are a few things in the textbook chapter on this that do some math, but I'm not going to do that part. I want you to know the words, the terms, and the concepts here, rather than the specific details of how you pay off a bond, how you calculate a sinking fund, and all that. You can stay tuned for another course I teach if you want to get into that detail. But for this course, we're going to talk about the overall structure, and there are a few things in this lecture that are not in the textbook, and I will flag those as I go along. But first of all, a bond is obviously, well, not obviously to people who don't know what a bond is. A bond is a security that represents an obligation by the issuer, a security that represents an obligation by the issuer, in other words, the borrower, to pay a certain amount of money to the purchaser, that is the lender, to pay a certain amount of money to the purchaser, that is the lender. That certain amount of money comes in two parts. It will be the principal, which with almost all bonds is paid off at the end of the life of the bond, and there will be interest along the way that is paid. Paying the interest is called debt service, and paying off the principal is called retirement of the bond. Now, it's got a different term with consumer bonds. We say amortization, because with consumer debt, you're paying the interest and paying down the principal as you go along. With corporate and government debt, and as I've said before, all you do is service the bond along the path of the bond's life, and then at the date of maturity, you get one last coupon interest payment, and you get the amount of money back at the end. Now, here's an interesting point about that. You have to pay back as a corporation. You borrow, let's say you issue $100 million in bonds, 20-year maturity, 8%. So over the life of that bond, every year, you're going to be paying interest on the $20 million, 8% interest. So you're going to be paying $160,000 every year, probably divided up into two payments or four payments. And then at the end, you'll make one last payment, and you will then also retire the face value of the bond, the $20 million. And the people who lend you the money, and not people, those who lend you the money are going to want to make sure that you have $20 million in the bank to be able to pay them. There are a couple of ways that they will ensure that this happens. One way that they will do it is to have in the covenants of the indenture agreement, in the covenants, in other words, the passages that make up the lending agreement, they will have a sinking fund provision. In other words, the company is required to put a certain amount of money into a secure bank account that the company can't touch every year over the life of the bond. Oh, didn't see that. Now, a straight line sinking fund, if on a $20 million 20-year debt, that would mean that the company would put in $1 million a year. Okay, but of course it would also be, they wouldn't necessarily have to put in $1 million if there's interest bearing, maybe $950,000. However, you don't usually see that. A lot of these sinking funds are tilted forward toward the front of the bond's life to make sure that they get the money all in there in a timely manner. So they don't, not, if there's a bad time for the company later on, the sinking fund is already secured at what it should, at near its value that it should be. So sinking funds can have all kinds of complex arrangements, where the money is deposited, who oversees the money. Usually a bond issue will have a trustee. A trustee is a third party agreed to by the borrower and the lender that oversees the covenants, the performance on the covenants of the bond. Make sure that the coupons are paid, make sure that the sinking fund is running properly and being funded properly, and make sure that other restrictive covenants are being abided. And I'll go back to restrictive covenants here in a minute. But let me tell you, there's another way the lenders can be assured of getting their face value back, aside from a sinking fund. There is something called a serial bond. What does the book call these? Staggered maturity. I know them as serial bonds. Essentially, a serial bond is like, let's say that I borrow $20 million over 20 years. Well, the way a serial bond would work, you would actually issue a cluster of maybe like 10 bonds. The first bond pays off in 10 years. The second one pays off at year 11. Third one pays off at year 12, et cetera, down the line, until by the end of the 20 years, the entire bond has been killed off. That would be a serial bond. You see the idea of it? They just sort of grind out this whole, they get $20 million right away. But somewhere along the line, they are actually retiring pieces of the entire bond issue, because it's not really one bond. It's a whole group of bonds that constitute a single offering. And the investors, the lenders, buy one of these groups of bonds, and then they start getting paid off along the way. Their money comes back to them. Couldn't remember. Yeah, again, the book calls these staggered maturity. Yeah.
Why would people want to buy certain bonds? Like, what's the benefit?
Well, one thing is that you know your money's going to start coming back to you relatively soon. It also spreads out your maturity premium risk, because you as a lender are going to be hurting whether interest rates go up or down. This sort of truncates that risk. Okay, I know some of my risk is gone at year 11. I know some of my risk is gone at year 12. So in a way, what it does is it makes it so that your whole package of money you've lent is not hanging 20 years. You know at least some of it's going to come back, and then whatever it is, up or down, you got some of your money back to do something with. But it is something that is a question, is which would be better, a bond that has just a sinking fund running on it or some kind of a serialized bond? I'll tell you one thing right now, a serialized bond, if I'm thinking that inflation is going to be a problem over the next 20 years, I would probably be more interested in serial bonds than I would be in straight up bonds. Here's the thing, inflation benefits borrowers and it hurts lenders. Think about it this way, and I'm going to do a little more on this in a few minutes here. Suppose that you have an inflation rate of an actual, not expected, an actual inflation rate of 2% per year. 2% per year. Okay, now, and this is a little math. I won't ask you to redo this on an exam, but I do want you to understand this concept. Let's say that you have a 20-year bond. In 20 years, you're going to get $10 million. That's the face value. You're going to get your $10 million. You lent $10 million now. In 20 years, you're going to get $10 million back. Now, let me, if I can get my calculator to work on this fool thing. Calculator. And I thought I had. Okay, I can't get my scientific calculator to pull up. Give me 1 second here. Let me see if I can find how in the world. I thought I had my scientific calculator would work. I thought I was going to be really modern on this. I just paid the price for that. Hang on here. Does anyone have a calculator? Right off. Thanks. So much for that app. I pull up the app and it's not a scientific calculator. It's just a 1 + 2 calculator. I'm going to just do this real quick here. On 1.02 to the 20th power. I'm going to take, compound a 2% inflation rate for 20 years. That would be 1 + 0.02 to the 20th power. That comes out to be 1.485, well, let me do just 1.4860. Now, that is the erosion. Take the reciprocal of that. And you get 1.06730. Times $10 million. And lo and behold, you get $6,729,713. Thank you. That's what inflation did to that face value over 20 years. That means that inflation is a scary thing for lenders because it erodes the purchasing power of the bond. That's where the coupon rate comes in, because the coupon rate will impound an expected inflation premium to try to compensate for that. But it doesn't compensate completely, and it's an expected inflation premium. When you set the bond out, you set your coupon rate then, and then if the inflation is above what you set it at, you are in serious trouble because you're getting that erosional impact of inflation on your debt. That's why in high inflation environments, it is smart to be a borrower before the inflation gets serious. You borrow money, and then you are not going to have to pay back nearly as much in real purchasing power dollars. So some lenders will, let me find a place where I can get a little bit of extra breathing room here. Okay, some lenders in the bond covenants, they will set up, first of all, there's what is called a straight bond. That's just a bond like the ones that I've been showing you, straight bond. And then there are other animals. Remember I told you about the callable bonds. If a bond is callable, the company can call it back whenever it wants. Well, not whenever it wants. The covenants will have some specific, okay, in 5 years from now, the company could pay off the bond at its discretion. It would probably do that if interest rates had fallen. It would just call the bond in, pay it off, and then refi at a lower coupon rate. And then there's another animal called a puttable bond. A puttable bond is a bond that the lender, after a certain amount of time, can put back to the borrower and say, pay me off. A puttable bond is a rather beastly instrument for the company that borrowed the money, because at some point, you know, they put a 20-year bond out there that is puttable after 6 years. The lenders can say, all right, 6 years. I know we had an agreement for 20 years, but it's a puttable bond. I'm putting it back to you now. Please pay me my money. I want my money back now. And then there are a couple of others. Another one was the convertible bond I mentioned to you, where the company, under certain conditions, could actually convert the bond to stock, which probably would be a really bad thing. If the company's in so much trouble that it can't pay its debt, then that probably means that the company's stock is worth crap too. And I've seen those kinds of bonds. They're actually, a lot of times those end up being junk bonds, but not always. Okay, now there is, of course, and as I said, there's a serial bond where there are staggered maturities. And then there's this animal called a variable rate bond, where the coupon is set at some, set according to some accepted base rate. So you might have a variable rate bond that is, let's say, LIBOR plus 3, or the Fed funds rate plus 6, or something like that. In other words, as interest rates in the economy move up and down, the bond moves up and down with them. Yeah. And I want to bring that up. Exactly, except no. Because adjustable rate mortgages are a terrible idea on stilts. You see, because they will adjust it upward whenever interest rates go up. But damned if they have a hard time adjusting that back down for you when interest rates go down. They just can't find why they should do it. With corporate bonds, there are going to be lawyers all over the place on both sides if the bond does not move actually with interest rates. With an adjustable rate mortgage, it is just legendary how many people have, when interest rates went up, their mortgage interest rate went up, but then when interest rates slipped back down, well, for some reason, their interest rate on their loan didn't slip back down. ARMs also have a really nasty feature, which is called the teaser. Teasers are these things. I'll tell you what. We're going to do an adjustable rate mortgage with you. We're going to start you out at 1% on this adjustable rate mortgage. Now, doesn't that sound like an incredible deal to you?
No.
Why not? You know damn well, but a lot of people don't. They'll, I got a 1% mortgage. Well, that was a teaser rate, and if they look at the contract, they'll see, oh, after 6 months, they can adjust it. Not only can they adjust it so that it is then floating with another rate, they can adjust it to compensate what they lost over the teaser rate time. So suddenly, you go from 1% up to a 12% mortgage. Gee, that's a real bargain. That can actually destroy people. That can cause bankruptcy. That can cause defaults very quickly. But they do it. And so variable rates in bonds are not as bad, but at the same time, you know, the company, here's the problem. If the interest rates are going up, that's probably going to mean that the economy is going to start hurting because those interest rates are going to slow down business. But that means that your debt, you're going to have to be paying higher coupons on the money you borrowed in the time period when the economy is beginning to suffer from the higher interest rates. So that kind of will be an adverse effect of this in itself. I see variable rate bonds, but I tend to avoid recommendations on them just because they just have this, they have exactly the wrong feature. When interest rates are going up, that's when businesses are starting to struggle, but that's when your coupon payments have to go up too because the variable rate has risen on it. And then there's an animal. You'll find some government bonds that do this, and I believe there are some corporate bonds, although I can't say that for sure. These are called indexed bonds. They are actually the principal is indexed to an agreed-upon inflation rate measure. So your face value and therefore your coupon move as inflation moves. So you start out with $1,000. Inflation goes 3%. So the face value after 1 year goes to $1,030, so the coupon percent is on $1,030 for the next period. You follow that? Index essentially protects you from inflation by buying these kinds of bonds as the lender. And they're actually kind of nice that way. And if you think that an inflation is coming, but you are not the not many people agree with you, investors don't agree with you, but if you think inflation is going to come, index bonds would probably be a good sheltering, inflation shelter. Yeah.
Is there a cap to how high?
No. And I actually had asked a question sort of like that. What would happen in a hyperinflation if inflation is running at like 30% a year? Do they have something where they say, no, we're not going to raise it anymore? Nope. It just keeps going. It rides with inflation. These indexed instruments like this, like I said, the best place for them. Okay, here's the problem. There is one downside to an indexed bond. The government issues these. The government is also probably the place where they will go to for the calculation of what the inflation rate is. So the government might have an incentive to understate what inflation is. We know for a fact, and if you took an economics course from me, I would go into a lot of detail. The way inflation is calculated by the U.S. government and by many governments around the world now is just so ridiculous that it's not capturing what's really happening by any means whatsoever. And they say, well, inflation is 1.7%. No, it's quite a bit more than that. There is a resource that I use for all of my inflation and in unemployment data called Shadow Government Statistics that takes out the massaging that the government does on its figures and gives you the real numbers, the numbers that without all of these statistical manipulations, well, that doesn't count, this doesn't count. They just say, this is inflation. And that would be a better place to go for an inflation information. But unfortunately, these indexed bonds, the government issues these indexed bonds, well, they're the ones who calculate the inflation rates to go into the indexing. And so you might want to be a little careful. Are they really going to tell you how bad inflation really is, or are they going to kind of play the game with you? I'm trying to think. Okay. Go through a couple of things here. Bonds come in two flavors. There are mortgage bonds, which otherwise you would call secured bonds, and there are debentures. A mortgage bond, they're both the same. They have an agreement. I pay you, give me this money, I pay you this back. But there's an attachment with a mortgage bond called the mortgage indenture agreement, the mortgage. And that's the way it is with private loans too. When you borrow money for a home, you're actually signing just a loan agreement, but there is an attachment called the mortgage agreement, which puts an asset on the line. The house. The same is true with a corporation. It can borrow money and say, all right, that factory right there is backing this. If we can't pay this bond off, you lenders get that building. It's yours. If we go into bankruptcy so we can't pay any of the lenders, you get that building. Notwithstanding anyone else's claim, you get that building. That is a mortgage bond. It's backed. A debenture doesn't have any overall back, it doesn't have any specific backing. If the company goes tap city, the company is liquidated. Any assets that are attached on mortgage bonds are satisfied with the money from the sale of those buildings or those assets, whatever it is. And then if there's money left over, then the debenture holders, the ones who borrowed without any security, they get whatever is left after that. So clearly, these are the safer bonds, and so they will pay a lower coupon rate because they are less risky than the debentures. And then it gets a little weird from there, because you get through what's called senior and subordinated. A senior instrument in bankruptcy, in liquidation, senior gets its money first. If the company goes bankrupt, everything's liquidated. First of all, the senior mortgage holders on a building. And then they might have borrowed again a second time on that building, backing it. Then the subordinated, if the building, let's say, the senior subordinated lent $20 million. The building sells for $40. They get their $20, and now let's say that the subordinated mortgage bond holders had $30 million. They'll get the other $20, but they're out $10. The senior and the subordinated in that order, senior and then subordinated. Sometimes they will call these junior. After the mortgage holders, the ones who actually have physical claim to something, get their money, if there's any left over, then the debenture holders will get theirs. Senior debenture, well, let me write up here. Senior mortgage. Senior debentures will then get theirs. And then underneath them, the subordinated debentures. And as you can see, the risk of these instruments gets worse, greater and greater the farther down you are. So you don't ever just buy a bond. You're buying some kind of security or no security. And you might think, well, I've got a mortgage bond, so I'm safe. If that's a subordinated mortgage bond, it's not as safe as you might think, because there is someone who lent that company money before who's got first dibs on that asset. You don't. I don't want to go into a lot on this, but it's like if the company liquidates, this pecking order is going to be enforced. An interesting thing about this that might be a little bit practical to you was that there have been a couple of cases that were kind of high profile over the last 10, 15 years where companies went into bankruptcy. Okay, so essentially they were defaulting on debt. So the debt holders took them to court, forced them into liquidation. And so the liquidation started to happen. And so the mortgage holders, the senior mortgage bonds, they got their money first. The subordinated mortgage holders got their money. And then the debenture, senior debentures got their money. Junior debentures got their money. Now, interestingly enough, along the way, this company, right up to the day that its doors closed, was taking orders from customers. And those orders had been being prepared in their warehouse, their fulfillment warehouse. And so technically, those customers were debt holders. The company owed them something, their merchandise. So a lawyer for these many, there were thousands of customers who were saying, excuse me, we get our merchandise, or we get it paid back what it's worth. And the courts ruled, no, you don't. You are the most subordinated of all debentures. See that warehouse that stuff was in? That warehouse was a covenant in a senior mortgage instrument. What's in that warehouse, therefore, is part of that senior mortgage instrument. So it's all liquidated, and it goes to those bondholders, those senior mortgage bondholders. You get somewhere between diddly and squat. In other words, you get diddly squat. You get nothing. And, of course, that just enraged consumer groups saying, no, actually, we are mortgage holders. We securitized. We lent them money, and it was backed by what they were going to send us. You see their logic? That's perfectly clear logic. But of course, you know, when you have mega trust funds and all that with their lawyers going up against little consumer group lawyers. It was a rout. It was a slaughter. There wasn't any hope, even though the logic was clear. It doesn't matter where physically it was. We had lent the company money on the promise that we would be paid back in that merchandise. So we were securitized debt holders. And the court said, well, no, you're not. Why not? Because you don't have enough money to impress me. So there you go. And if it sounds like I'm being facetious in my cynicism, no, that's exactly how it works. If you don't have lawyers, you're not going to get good, incredible lawyers. You're not going to win in a court these days, period, and especially in a business court. But anyway, enough of making you feel good about the future. I want to make a point here. Bought the indenture agreement. I mentioned that before. Let me say a couple of things real quick here. Indenture agreement. This is the contract. Wherefore the parties of the first part and the parties of the second part have sniffed each other's asses and decided that we are all fragrant in the buttock area. It's the whole contract. And we say the covenants, when we talk about the covenants, those are those clauses in the contract that specify how performance proceeds. And there will be a trustee that will be in the covenants, there will be a trustee named who will oversee performance of the covenants. Now, the covenants of the contract, because the lenders are in the position of power, they will have these things that give them more assurance that the company will live long enough to pay them back, to make them whole. So, in the covenants, you'll have restrictive covenants. Now, the restrictive covenants can be all kinds of different things. One common restrictive covenant is some kind of a control on payment of dividends. No, you can't pay your shareholders giant dividends. You owe us. So don't just disgorge everything you've got to make your shareholders happy. Sometimes companies actually like that because they can say, well, we're not paying, you know, you want us to jack our dividend up 10% every year, blah, 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 or you want us to start issuing dividends. Well, we'd love to, but those mean old bondholders won't let us do it. There's this restrictive covenant. So sometimes that's not all that bad for the company. It gives them butt coverage for not doing things that the shareholders might want, the principals might want, that probably wouldn't be good for the company anyway. So that's a restrictive covenant. Sometimes restrictive covenants can have to do with the management, the types of projects, what they can do with the money that they're borrowing is obviously a big part of it, what they can do after they borrow the money. Interestingly, let's say that Facebook had, instead of issuing all of that stock, it had borrowed $6 billion. If it had done that, I can double damn well guarantee you that Facebook's owner would have never bought Oculus. It would not have happened because that is a very dangerous move. The bondholders, no, you're never, ever going to buy some stupid thing like that. Another one that would have been, what was the other thing that he bought? Can't remember. What was it? Anyway, you can't do that. Restrictive covenants stop that kind of thing in their tracks. Never would that happen. Another thing, let me put, dividends. Another one. Projects. Another one, management. There might be some rules on who you can put in there. There might be even some requirement that you bring in certain directors to make sure that things stay good in the company. Another one that you might see in there, location. The famous story I probably already told you of the management group that helped out Staples. Staples wanted to grow. They were struggling a little bit. They needed a boost. So this consulting group came swooping in and said, we're going to do all of this for you. We're going to lend you all, set up this borrowing. So you're going to borrow huge amounts of money to boost your operations. And you don't even have to pay us. We'll just put our fee into the amount of money you borrow. Couple tens of millions of dollars for us helping you do this. But as part of the restrictive covenants, you're going to have to move your operations over to China. You're going to also have to close some of your stores. You're going to have to get rid of some of your people. All of that. And we will lend you all this money, and you don't even have to pay us anything because we're just going to fold that into the debt that we have for you. Did anyone read Staples? What happened? They're dead now. Yes, and it was Bain Capital, the famous Mitt Romney capital firm. And Staples is dead now. It's dead. It's been dead for years. Did you ever go into a Staples? In the last 10 years, it was dying over the last 10 years. It had been saddled with so much debt and so many restrictive covenants and so much extra debt that was nothing but the consulting fee that didn't even turn into assets for the company. It was just they had to pay the consultants their huge amount of money. It was over before they even started. And finally, Staples, it was a zombie for a long time. Now, let me tell you a couple of things about bonds. I wrote down one thing that I want. Bonds come in all kinds of flavors. And one more. Here's a weird-ass bond. We got the straight, callable, puttable, convertible, serial, variable rate, indexed. There's one called a strip. A strip, I won't tell you what STRIP stands for. You'd probably never remember it anyway. You never will need to. But here's how a strip works. Okay, madam, I'm going to lend you money. You need $1 million. Okay, get $1 million. So now what's going to happen is that you are going to do, we're going to do this as a serialized bond. Staggered maturity, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year. Okay? So now what I'm going to do is I lend you the money, I get this bond. And then I issue my own bond backed by the bond that you issued. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to borrow money from you, and I will pay my money back to you. Essentially, I'm going to issue you 5-0 coupon bonds and retire each of them as I get the money from you. And so that, what I've sold to you, is the strip. Or I could actually sell you the 1 year zero coupon bond, you the 2 year, you the 3 year, you the 4 year, and you the 5 year. And then when, as you pay me, I then use part of that money to pay you the first year, your coupon payments to me, or your retirement on year one. I use part of that to pay to you. I use part of that to pay to you. I use part of that to pay to you. You're thinking, well, how do you make money off this? How in the world would you ever make money off this? Because what I'm going to do is, you are risky as hell. I mean, look at this person. My God. Hey, ma'am. And so what's going to happen is I'm going to charge you a very high interest rate. Let's say 12%. But I am a safe person. And I am selling you bonds that are backed by an asset. It's a sucky bond, but it's an asset. So I've got an asset-backed bond that I will sell to you. You'll get a low interest rate because I'm safe and my bond to you is secured. Mm-hmm. Same to you, same to you, same to you. My interest rate that I'll pay you is 3% for a 1 year, 4% for a 2 year, 5% maturity premium sealed But along the way, all I'm doing is just making money because you're paying me at 12% and I'm paying you at lower interest rates on the strip flip. You follow the idea? Does that sound weird?
Yep.
There are billions and billions of dollars of those every day. Strips are a very common instrument. They are actually a kind of what is called a derivative. You ever heard of derivatives? They are the things that will destroy the universe someday. Even saying the word derivative, say it. Don't say that word, okay? Really. I'm serious. They are bad. You see what the danger is? If you essentially die, then I just say, whoa, I can't pay you, 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 and you. Well, you're dead. And you guys are going to simply go after me. And I'm saying, don't go after me. The bond was securitized by that asset. You go after her. And suddenly, you don't have me bothering you. I'll just sit back with the money that I made and let you guys go after the security, liquidating your asset. Okay? Does that sound phony? Welcome to the world of finance. That's a tame instrument compared to a lot of them. But they all have that, a lot of the instruments have that same feature. What you're doing is you're playing like a game. I am going to charge you some really high, stupid rate. And then what I'll do is I will fold there's a security. You sold me a bond, okay? So now I've got an asset. It's a risky as hell asset, but it's an asset. And then what I will do is I will make a new instrument backed by that asset. But you don't see that asset. You see me. And so please don't look at that sorry-ass person over there. Look at me. Look at me. There you go. Now, you want mine? Yeah, sure. I mean, safe 5%. I charge you 15%. So what I do is I just collect the money from you and pay a little bit of it to you, and I sit back and hold. And even if you go down, you're dead. You go into bankruptcy on me. I just step back and say, there's the security. Talk to her. You follow it? Very common. This is essentially the hallmark of these derivatives. And what would happen is that they would securitize. The game worked like this, and then I'll get off the subject, but I want you to understand how bad and dangerous the game was, and it's still going on. They didn't learn in 2007 and 2008, and it's still going on. What I would do is I would lend you money, high-risk instrument, 15%. I would securitize that on you. You're kind of risky, 10%. Okay, but what I would do is I would simply take money and I would borrow from you, back it on that security. But that wouldn't be the end of the game. Now I have 1-2, a subordinated and a senior, and I will use those to back a security on you. 1-2-3. And then what I'll do is I have 3 securities. I have a senior subordinated, a junior, and then I will use those to back on you a 4th security. And by the time it would get, and how far did this go? In fact, many of these, we couldn't even find the original start of the security. There were so many levels, we couldn't even find where the thing started. And essentially, by the time we went back, let's say, 4, 3, where the hell's 2? Oh, 2's dead. Well, where's 1? Well, we can't find 1 without 2 because the security on 2 was from 1. I can't do any talk to you. Well, you're gone anyway. But even if I could, security on you is gone, so I'm stuck right there. Do you follow the game? The stack level on some of the securities, they would essentially multiply the borrowing from, let's say, 1,000,000 to 4,800,000 until at the end of the game in 2008, the notional value of what was supposed to be backing the derivatives, as I had mentioned before in class, was $63 trillion. $63 trillion essentially had been created out of this group of derivative securities that were being played like this. Ultimately, there's no way to ever recover most of it, although 19 trillion of it was voted to be covered by the United States Treasury in a very quiet vote in 2010. So essentially it's not any ridiculous number like 63 trillion because you guys owe 19 trillion of it. You essentially became the guarantors of it retrospectively. But the rest of it's still out there, about $44 trillion, which is more than the GDP of every nation on Earth. But what the hell? You weren't planning to do anything else with your life but be in debt anyway. Tell you another one, real quick. This is a historical example, but it's a warning. It's a warning shot because we don't want to ever do this again. And yet, it looks like we could. And it's a World War II. In the United States, we had, you know, we lost a lot of boys, and we had some pretty nasty stuff done at Pearl Harbor. But overall, the United States, usually in wars, absent the Civil War, we just sit back on our fat asses and watch other countries being wrecked. We send our boys over there to die, and then we just sit back. Boy, we really suffered through that one. Let's all come home and feel bad about ourselves about that. But the reality of it is that Europe was just trashed. Japan was just trashed. I mean, it was just beyond belief, the damage level. From the bombings, we bombed the hell out of Germany. Germany bombed the hell out of England with those buzz bombs. It was just a mess. Right after the war, the photographs, and there are plenty of those still around, you can just see literally cities were just rubble all over Europe. The infrastructure was just shattered. And so we had a plan. We are going to rebuild Europe. We are going to pay for the rebuilding of Europe. We'll do it. It was called the Marshall Plan. And essentially what we were doing is setting ourselves up as the leader of the new free world post-World War II. By doing this, we could have all countries look to us as sort of the economic, military, and ideas leader of the last half of the 20th century. It worked. But there were a couple of nasty things that happened as a result. Here's one. There were bonds that were issued to finance this operation, to finance this rebuilding of Europe. So they were called Yankee bonds. And the way it would work is this. The Europeans, some of it we just gave them money, but a lot of it is we said, all right, industries of Europe, wealthy industrialists, capitalists of Europe, we will lend you money. We'll lend you money to get yourselves back on your feet. Low interest rate loans. So in other words, there was some of it was no interest, low interest, some of it was grants, but there were hundreds and hundreds of millions, well, billions of dollars in these loans that European borrowers borrowed from the United States. And so you're a German. You look German, sort of. Not really, but you're a German. Okay, so you want to rebuild your industry that was bombed back to the Stone Age by our Allied planes. Now we're friends, and so you need to borrow $1 million. Okay, sure, why not? So you borrow $1 million from me on the Marshall Plan. So I send you $1 million, which you then will very quickly take to the bank of your country, which will say we will give you the equivalent in a German currency. And you say, oh, no, that's okay. Because you see, the dollar is backed by gold, so I should like the gold instead. Well, that's not the German bank's gold. That would be our gold in the United States. So we were going to lend you money in dollars, and you worked it so that instead of giving you the money in dollars, we gave it to you in gold. You did that. You did that. Every son of a bitch in Europe borrowed money in dollars, and when the dollars came to them, they just immediately turned them into a demand for gold from Fort Knox, and they drained us. They literally wiped out our gold in Fort Knox. We never recovered. There's not even the percentage of gold now compared to what was there before World War II. In World War II, it's a minuscule fraction because everyone in Europe figured out very quickly that we backed our dollar with gold so they could go with those dollars that we lent them and they could go to their banks and say, go back to the United States and say, we want the gold instead of the dollar. Because they had to, our bank, our central bank, had to honor, because we backed our currency with gold, we had to give you the gold. And you, and all of you got gold in Europe, and we were sitting there, don't you want our dollars? Yeah, eventually we'll want those, but right now we kind of like that gold. So bring it on, chop chop, bring it on. And so we got wiped out of our gold. Two lessons to learn there. One was, you hear these people talk about, we got to go back to a gold standard. Gold standards can be wrecked. They are so easy to destroy. Don't even dream of going back to a gold standard, because someone's going to figure out a way to drain what little gold we have left. And once we run out of gold at Fort Knox, well, we're going to go for those nice gold teeth of yours, Pimp Daddy. you follow the idea? And the other lesson to be learned was that it was just clear that we just didn't see the trick before it happened. That's why you have all of these lawyers, these finance people. Whenever there is a bond issue going to be done by anyone anywhere, the question is not what can go right, but how could someone play games on us with this trick, play tricks on us with this bond. So you always want to make sure that every possible scenario is covered. So if they had thought before they lent you that money, if I had thought before I lent you that money, I would have said, you may not, as a foreigner, convert that dollar into gold, even though we are on a gold standard. That would have forced you to just take the dollars, turn them into the German currency, and go about rebuilding your industry. Instead of having you take the gold and then use the gold however you wanted, some of it you did rebuild. They rebuilt Europe with it. But they also creamed our gold base at the same time by doing so. It was essentially a transfer of gold out of the United States to the Europeans. Are they bad people for that? Hell no. If you figure out that you can do that, of course you're going to do that. I can lend you $100 and you can go and build your business, or you can have a pile of gold to play with, and then when it goes up in price, you can use some of it to build your business. Which are you going to take? You're probably going to take the gold real fast. And so that is the story of the Yankee bonds, and it's also the cautionary tale. Gold standards are extraordinarily vulnerable to a lot of different things, but that's one of them, is that they can end up, you don't plan it to happen, but they can end up wiping out your gold base in the country. And the other cautionary tale, of course, is watch if you are a lender. If you are a lender, the restrictive covenants are your only way that you are going to control what the borrower does. So make sure that your restrictions are incredibly clear. So when you come to me, sir, for that $100 loan, I'm going to have a document that will be about 3 inches thick, and it will tell me it will govern you over the life of that borrowing. And you say, I don't want to be that restricted like that. Good. You don't get my money. Let that be a lesson to you. That's all I have for you. I thank you.